For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week, Read On producer Hannah Taus discusses chimpanzees, language and consciousness with award-winning author T.C. Boyle. Narrator Caroline Lennon looks back on her long association with RNIB Talking Books and the notorious role she played in The Archers. And Robert Kirkwood goes monster hunting with author Ian Mark. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Established in 1969, the Booker is the world's oldest and most highly respected prize for literary fiction, and has been awarded to some of the most influential authors of the last half century writing in English. And this year, there was a truly international flavour to the shortlist decision. The six novels selected for the shortlist were A Passage North by Anouk Arud Pragasam, in which the protagonist, Krisham, travels from Colombo to the war-torn northern province for a funeral and tries to make sense of the past 30 years' civil war. The Promise by Damon Galgut, which is set on a farm outside Pretoria and tells of a white South African family that has failed to keep a promise to the black woman who has worked for them throughout her whole life. No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood, in which real life intrudes upon the world of a woman known for her viral social media posts. The Fortune Men by Nadifa Mohammed, in which suspicion falls on Mahmoud Mukhtan for the murder of a shopkeeper in Cardiff's Tiger Bay in 1952. Bewilderment by Richard Powers, which is about a widowed astrobiologist trying to raise his 9-year-old son. Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead, which is the story of a female aviator who disappears in 1950 while attempting to fly around the world. As in previous years, Read On will hope to bring you interviews with all the shortlisted authors. And if you want to shadow the judges while they make their final decision, don't forget that you can read along thanks to the generosity of the Booker Foundation, as all the shortlisted titles from this and previous years will be available from the RNIB Library. For more information, check out the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
If you need someone who understands sight loss, we're here for you. Our free and informal Living Well with Sight Loss courses aim to help you increase your independence, boost your confidence, and connect with others to share experiences. Join a course by visiting rnib.org.uk/livingwellwithsightloss or call us on 0303 123 9999.
T.C. Boyle is the author of 17 books, 11 short story collections, and the recipient of numerous literary awards. His latest book, Talk to Me, tells the story of Sam, a young chimpanzee who has been taught sign language and brought up as a human by a professor of psychology called Guy Schemmerhorn. But looking after Sam is wreaking havoc on Guy's personal life, so he hires shy undergraduate Amy to babysit. She quickly devotes herself to Sam's care and Guy's project. But when Guy's funding is at risk, and Sam taken away by his villainous boss, Professor Moncrief, Amy discovers just how far she'll go to protect her beloved ward. The book is a wry examination of man's attempt to shape an animal in his own image, and it's based on experiments carried out on chimps in the 1970s. Producer Hannah talked to T.C. Boyle from his home in California.
T.C. Boyle, welcome to Read On.
It's my pleasure, Hannah. Thank you for inviting me.
So, I wondered whether you could give our audience a little bit of an introduction to your new book, Talk to Me.
Well, for a long time, I've been sort of obsessed with animal consciousness. My last book was Outside Looking In, about human consciousness, and specifically how it was changed through the use of LSD. This book now examines what animals know and what they might think. And I've gone back to the late 1970s, when we were doing experiments to try to teach chimpanzees to speak our language. It has always fascinated me because we've been told since we were children that what distinguishes us from the other animals and allows us to use them and make use of them any way we want is that we alone can use language. Well, it turns out that a chimpanzee has the intelligence of a 3.5-year-old child and the verbal abilities of a child as well.
So, as you say, the book's set in the late 1970s. I assume that it was easier to set it in this period rather than later, when the ethics of using animals for research became far more of an issue.
Well, absolutely. But again, it is an historical novel, and I'm examining what happened in that period. These experiments with chimps, language experiments, have petered out over the years. I mean, some are still going on because we got as far as we could possibly advance with that. And I think we begin to ask the questions, as you suggest. What are the ethics of keeping an animal as intelligent as a 3.5-year-old child in a cage for his entire life? And don't forget, the experimental animals were juveniles. A chimpanzee is several times stronger than the strongest man on earth. And they become, in adolescence, like us, difficult to handle. And so you see all these adorable chimps on TV and movies and so on, and in these experiments, but those are juveniles. Once they become adolescents, they are no longer capable of being used with human beings. They couldn't be trusted. And so here's an animal that can live to be 50 years old with this intelligence, and they were confined then to cages for the rest of their lives, and most often used in biomedical experiments.
Amy, who is one of the protagonists of your story and looks after Sam, the chimpanzee in question, is almost a submissive character. She becomes more and more assertive as the book goes on. Do you think that her assertiveness grows because of her love for Sam or because of her sense of protecting him and thinking that she's doing the right thing?
Both, and also because she comes into herself. She was an undergrad, you know, just dribbling along as many of us did as undergrads. And she was empowered by discovering what she wants to do in life, and that is to work with animals. And I made her non-assertive and rather small also, for obvious reasons in this novel. But as you say, as the novel progresses, she has a vast change of character. And I think it's because of the issues that we're talking about. She becomes aware of the ethics of confining other intelligent beings. And of course, I've written about this many times in many, many forms. It also extends to our use of the earth, our destruction of the earth, our destruction of habitats. Chimpanzees, for instance, do have a language which is primarily gestural, and it's gotten them through evolution to this point perfectly well. However, we've destroyed their environment, and we have captured them and put them in cages and subjected them to our experiments. Now, it is fascinating to think, could we communicate with another animal species on a level beyond what we do with the dog and the cat and so on? Could we speak to them? Would they have anything to tell us about the essence of life on Earth that we don't know ourselves? Dr. Doolittle, it's a fascinating idea. But in fact, that's apples and oranges. We are dealing with a consciousness that has developed in order to thrive in its own environment. That environment no longer exists. And I think finally people began to realize that, yes, we can teach dolphins to fetch a ball. We can teach them to think and do puzzles, and we can do it with chimps and so on. But really, we're not going to have any major revelation about life.
I wondered whether Guy, who's one of the other protagonists, falls in love with Amy because it's her or because of her unique ability and skill with understanding Sam.
I see him, as you enter the book, he's the professor, she's the student. He's just looking for somebody to do the heavy lifting in this experiment, to care for the chimp, to feed him and wash him and mind him and babysit him throughout the day. His previous relationship has just broken up over this because it is difficult to live in a house with a wild animal. And she's very pretty. She's submissive. And he likes that. I do think, to give him some credit, as the relationship evolves, he does genuinely fall in love with her. But he's always a kind of calculating character as a scientist who wants primarily to advance his career and to be on TV with this wonderful, brilliant speaking ape so that he can advance in academia and become a full professor, for instance. So he is a calculating sort of guy. I love to write these male characters, the punks and the calculating ones, because I, of course, am a saint. And I can see the other side of the coin if I can.
Well, I was just about to come on to one of your villains in the novel, who, well, you could say that Guy is a bit of a villain in his own way, but Moncrief, who has loaned, shall we say, Sam to Guy. He takes the part of the villain. He even has the eye patch to match it. His ego allows no morality whatsoever. So how long did you spend planning his comeuppance, and how delightful was it to get him there?
Hey, well, I think you could probably see that coming a long ways off. It is fun to have a villain in the piece. And historically, there was a figure similar to Moncrief, because, again, you're looking at the 70s, and suddenly these animals are in great demand. And that day, they were cost $10,000, so it's quite a bit of money. And so he filled a niche. He was a professor and a psychologist, the historical figure, whom I won't name. And he began to breed them as you would breed a dog or a cat, just so he could supply them where they were needed, and also so he could run these experiments and advance his own career by having various people around the country take a chimp into their house and raise that animal from birth as a human being to do experiments with regard to the acquisition of language. How do we acquire language? It's certainly not in school. We know how to speak by the time we go to school. It's through living in a household and picking up the cues of what the people in the household say. So that was the experiment, and this was the guy. And he was a natural villain for this piece. And as far as the eye patch is concerned, the rumor is that a chimp had torn out his eye, because, of course, these animals can be very savage, and they are caged. And he, in the breeding facility, has the worst of them and the oldest of them, because they're no longer fit for experiments, and so he uses them for breeding. And so everyone is quite in awe of him because of what this was. But, of course, that may not have been the case. It may simply have been an auto accident. I leave that up for the reader to decide. But nonetheless, yeah, he's the bad guy in this.
Sam has his own voice in the novel, and several of the chapters are written from his viewpoint. How difficult was it not to over-anthropomorphize him?
Yes, this was the central joy of the novel for me and what got me going on it in the first place. We have alternating chapters from his point of view. I don't know exactly how it happens, but I was able to enter his consciousness. Now, every novel is a kind of trick, and the reader has to agree to being part of this trick. We believe that a character, we're feeling a character's point of view, even if it's an eye narration. Nonetheless, we know that some artist has constructed this, but we fall into it anyway. And so I tried to imagine the same sort of thing for Sam as I would for any other character. And what was interesting was, how much vocabulary does he have? And of course, the trick with the novelist is that the reader knows that, yes, I am writing the book and I am constructing these sentences, but I will often point out that a word that I'm using is one that he doesn't quite know yet. I was thrilled to be able to enter his consciousness and write from his point of view.
At one point when he goes outside after he's trapped with Moncrief, he talks about how cold it is and trying to relate ice to his experience of ice cream. And I kind of thought that that was the perfect example of creating the concept out of what you already knew.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, what helped me with this is in the house right now is a 2-year-old. And I watched this child. The book was delivered over a year ago, so he was even younger, to watch the acquisition of language. And in fact, exactly what you're saying happened yesterday. He had ice in his cup and he wondered, what is ice? Just as Sam does. And so we gave him an explanation and a demonstration.
Yeah. So I've got to ask, what does Sam's voice sound like in your head?
Well, my dear, if we have time, perhaps I could read you just a little bit of Sam.
That would be amazing.
Okay, this is the first Sam chapter, and it's called Key Lock Out, words that he knows and that he wants to put together in a sentence, because he has now been removed and put into a facility run by Moncrief, and he's bewildered and doesn't know where he is. He didn't have a word for words, or not yet anyway, but he knew words all the same. He knew key. He knew lock. He knew out. He was a prisoner, though he didn't have a word for that either. And even if he did, it would have been meaningless. What did a word, any word, have to do with this situation, in this place, in the onrushing, unstoppable cataract of now, and the fear, afraid, that came with it? He wanted his blanket. A blanket. Any blanket. He was cold. He was distraught. He rocked from side to side. He stared at nothing. He plucked the hairs from his arms, his chin, the crown of his head, trichotillomania. And he didn't know that term either. How could he? And what would it matter if he did? Would that get him out of here?
You've obviously done a huge amount of research into animal behavior and linguistics. Where did you start with that journey?
I do have a friend who's a primatologist. She introduced me to one of her students who works at the LA Zoo with chimps, and I was able to go and observe them and speak with her. But primarily I'm getting this from the superb books written in the period about these experiments, which are very detailed and from which I get a lot of the information. And my job as a novelist, of course, is to take that information and make it into a drama. And in this one, my intention is to explore something. But as it begins to cohere and the book moves on, I realize what's happening and what it is. I want to break your heart in this book, and I hope I succeed.
You've taken the words right out of my mouth. You did break my heart completely.
Some years ago, on Father's Day, at the Hammer Museum in L.A., I gave a reading in conjunction with my daughter, who was also a writer. She introduced me, and I introduced her, and we each read. And afterward, on stage, she was being questioned by the impresario of this. And he said to her, "Have you ever seen your father cry?" And she said, "Only once." And it was when I was reading Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men aloud to them, the children, and got to the end. So that's the kind of effect I was hoping for with the climax of this book. And I'm the sort of writer who wants all kinds of effects. You know, I'm known as a satirist. Okay, great. Probably my proudest moment was with the book San Miguel some years ago. It's a book about the island off of the coast here called San Miguel. And I was working from two narratives, a fragmentary diary and a memoir left by women who had lived there individually many years ago. And I realized that I didn't want to make it satiric. I wanted to sort of honor their voices and the way that they presented themselves in this island. And so I, as a challenge for me, I wrote a realistic, non-comic, non-ironic narrative. And it was so difficult, I almost gave it up. But I'm very glad that I pursued it. And so with this book, too, although this has plenty of comedy in it as well because of Sam, but I like to try for all different effects in my fiction. If you look at all the stories, the two big book of collected stories, you'll find the stories of every kind and mode. And sometimes when I'm writing stories, I will write the flat out, you know, laugh aloud satire back to back with a story like Chicxulub, which is not only about the fate of an individual, but the fate of the species at large and the planet. So I'm not a writer who wants to be confined. And so I do try to do different things each time. With that said, of course, you can see the themes and obsessions that I have working through all of these books. In fact, this book, I look back on my very first book, which is called Descent of Man, after Darwin. And I wrote it as a student in the early 1970s. And it was when I first discovered that we were teaching chimps our language. And I wrote a very absurdist, wild story. But it also happened to have a sort of love triangle in it between a female researcher, her boyfriend, and a very, very bright chimp.
So do you feel like you've come full circle in a way?
In this particular case, yes. But there are many more circles I have to pursue.
Absolutely. I was going to say, you have a very wide range of topics that you've written on. And as you say, some of them are absurdist, some of them are satirical. You have magical realism that floats in. Where do you get those aha moments? What is it that triggers you to think, I can write something out of that?
So right now, I'm about two-thirds of the way through a new novel, which is set currently. It's called Blue Skies. It's set currently and into the future. As I did with A Friend of the Earth in 2000, I projected global warming to now. I'm going to move a little further into the future. I hope to be able to finish that at the end of the year or early next year. And then I will go to short stories. In the meanwhile, whatever you might tell me or anybody might tell me or I read in the newspaper, I might jot down an idea. It's never an extensive idea. It's just a topic usually. And then when it's time to write stories, I page through those and look at them. Next year, I'll have a new book of 13 stories out. They're very various, of course, including the whimsical, including some realistic pieces, some absurdist pieces, some pieces about what's happening with science today. For instance, Are We Not Men? A story about CRISPR technology and what it's going to lead to, possibly. So the aha moment happens when I begin to write. I don't know what it will be. I never know what it will be. I just absorb material and think about it. And the deep thinking comes in the line-to-line writing, which, by the way, is the beauty, from my point of view, of what I do. It's magical. I don't know what it will be. Again, this is why I am only content to write fiction. I have my PhD, you know, I'm a professor emeritus now, and so on. But the artistic side is what appeals to me and what I want to do and what I want to be. I don't want to give speeches. I don't want to write essays. I just want to pursue this kind of magic of writing fiction. What will it be? I never know.
And how do you go about determining then whether an idea is going to be a short story or a full-length novel?
I've never had the experience of taking a story idea and making a novel, or vice versa. I guess I'm kind of set and rigid in a way. I conceive of these ideas as stories in my notebook, and that doesn't change. So I will write a novel, and then I will write stories until that peters out, maybe 6 or 7 stories, maybe 9 months or so. Then I will write another novel, and then I will conclude that book of stories. And that's, I've just concluded a book of stories, a new novel, and I'm hoping to write new stories maybe next year from whatever's happening now. And what is happening? You'll notice that many of my stories are addressing exactly what's happening in the moment. Technological change, for instance, like CRISPR, or another story, The Relive Box, about gaming and playing games and so on. The stories allow me to address all the crazy changes that happen so rapidly in our society and in our environment as well.
So you've mentioned briefly what you're working on next. Can you expand on that a bit at all, or is it still tightly under wraps?
It's pretty much tightly under wraps, but I can say this. It deals with what's happening with regard to the environment and global warming, again, from a friend of the Earth back in 2000, and how it's come up on us much more quickly than we could ever have imagined and is affecting us catastrophically. You heard the UN report the other day on the environment, for instance. I'll say this, nature bites back. That's what I'm working on in many, many, many configurations. And it hurt. Ouch.
Well, I very much hope that you will come back onto the show when you have completed it. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Hannah. It's been a delight.
Talk to Me is available in print and ebook with an audio version on its way soon. And T.C. Boyle will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, roving reporter Robert Kirkwood goes monster hunting with author Ian Mark. But before that, the list of talking books narrated by Caroline Lennon reads like a roll call of the best in contemporary Irish fiction. Sebastian Barry, Maeve Binchy, Roddy Doyle and Anne Enright are all there amongst many others. She's a busy woman, but not too busy to drop into the Connect studio and tell me about her life as a narrator and of her love of books. Caroline Lennon, welcome to Read On.
Oh, hello. I feel very glad to be here.
So, how did you come to be a narrator for R&IB Talking Books?
Well, the whole thing started, I used to be on a radio show called The Archers. And
I know, they killed you off, didn't they?
No. First of all, they sent me to Germany, the ultimate punishment. And when that wasn't enough, I died for good. But while I was doing that, I got rung up by a producer of audiobooks and said, oh, would you like to try out doing this? Because it's not for everybody, you know. And I thought, oh, yes, I love books, love words. But yeah, I'll give it a go. And the first book that I did was enormously long. And I did think, ooh, what have I taken on? And it was a real learning experience. And then I've done quite a few at this stage, and I just got heard. And they said, ooh, do you want to come and record at the R&IB? And I said, why not? I do it everywhere else. So why not do it here? Lovely.
And can you remember what the first book you recorded was?
The first book that I ever recorded?
Yeah.
Yes, I can. I'm going to try to think of... Yes, I think it was Isabel's Wedding by an Irish, very successful Irish writer called Sheila O'Flanagan. And I remember that at one point the character goes to Spain and there was a lot of Spanish pronunciations of food. I'm a big fan of food. And I did a lot of my card Spanish accent, which I found intensely amusing. I'm not sure the producer thought it was as amusing as I did. But anyway, yeah, so that was my first one. And it was very long. So it was a real sort of baptism of fire. And you just have to build up the muscles for recording over a lot of material with lots of changes in it over a number of days. It's a very interesting process.
And you guys don't do massive amounts of retakes. I mean, a lot of it is first take recording, isn't it?
Yes, I think there's the time factor. So I always think of it as old school acting, you know, like I've older chums of mine who were lucky enough to do things like Weekly Rep, where they'd be doing a major play in the evening, maybe a Shakespeare or a Shaw, and rehearsing something else in the day. So you, again, it's like another kind of muscle. You learn to make quick decisions and make them work. And sometimes, of course, they don't. And you think, oh, why did I go with that voice for that character? But you have to live with it. So it's very much at the cliff face of acting work, you know, and you can't be precious. I think most people who do this kind of work would be what you call good natural sight readers, which I think is really a technical thing where, whether you realise it or not, your eye has flicked along at super high speed to the end of the line, rather than sitting slowly on each word. So, in fact, you're reading off a memory of the whole line, I think. That's my understanding. I've noticed it myself. So, in a way, as I'm saying the word, I'm seeing it for a second time.
And, as you said, you were Siobhan Hathaway in The Archers for many years.
The Irish slapper,
Did you know you were going to be killed off?
Oh, yes, they did tell me. In fact, I was very lucky, really, because originally when I joined the show, I don't think there was the intention for it to become such a big character. And the character and the storyline just landed and they came to me and said, oh, look, we're going to do some more with this. And I went, oh, yeah, fantastic, because it's a really enjoyable process. You'll hear actors say this a lot, and I'm sure people think we're all being very twee, but radio is fantastically good fun to do. And so the story developed over a number of years, really. I mean, I wasn't speaking all the time. When I first turned up, I always say this, and it's true, I think I spent the first 2 years going in for half a dozen eggs in Betty's shop. So I did say to them, is she going to turn out to be a big meringue maker or something? Because they said, no, we've got something else in mind. So yes, I did know that my end was coming. Yes, indeed.
And how does that compare to being a talking books narrator? Is it as immediate? Do you only do it in one?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think the biggest difference is, of course, when you're a narrator, it's just you. So it's you and the microphone. And, of course, if you're doing a show like The Archers, you're with your fellow cast members. I mean, some scenes you might do on your own, but mostly you're having conversations and interacting with other actors who are right beside you. The similarity is, I guess, that the performance, all of it, anything that you're doing, goes through the mic. So when I'm doing a book, the image that happens for me, that works for me, is I imagine that the microphone is the ear of somebody that I'm speaking to, or their face. And when you're doing a radio play, it's the same thing. Actually, you're sending the performance through the microphone. So your companions are beside you, and you will make some eye contact with them. But there's a weird sort of mental thing that has to happen where you're sending the performance. You know, if you were doing a telly or a film, it's through the camera. So when you're doing recorded work, it happens through the microphone.
And obviously with the talking book, you are the entire ensemble cast. I suppose you're a director as well as an actor at that point as well,
that's,
are you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very astute observation. I think that is it. And I think why actors, because it's not at all glamorous job, let me tell you. But why actors like doing it when we like doing it, it's because, again, it's that old school thing where it's a very pure form of acting. Because all the different characters that you get to do, characters are characters because of what they do. And a lot of theatre or film and TV work, you're boringly typecast if you're lucky enough ever to work, but you're employed to look a certain way because you look a certain way and because you sound a certain way, which I'm sure people notice when they turn on the TV and they see the same actors doing everything. They're employed to do that for that reason. Whereas when you get to do a book, you get to play them all. And it's, if you bring the right attitude to it, it is fantastically good for your acting because you are using every bit of yourself. And I think that's, once you get used to playing all the parts and deciding the tone of a scene and everything, it can be quite hard to go back to being just a small cog in the machine.
I mentioned in the introduction that the list of books that you've narrated for the RNIB reads as a roll call of the best contemporary Irish writers. Clearly there's a reason you get given Irish books to narrate as well as other books. But do you have a particular penchant for the Maeve Binchys and Roddy Doyles that you've been reading?
Well, I think the great thing about Irish literature is the love of the word. You know, we love the word in Ireland, and it doesn't mean we're any nicer than anybody else, but we do love a social interaction. Mm. And I think the best Irish writing captures that quality. And it's just such fun to get your mouth around these fantastically witty expressions. You know, Maeve Binchy is so totally different, of course, to Roddy Doyle. But what they share is, I think, a genuine love of people. And you, I think you have to, if you're a writer, I think if you have that love and you love listening and observing people, that can come out in your writing. And people often talk about there's a warmth in Irish writing, and I think that's what they mean, even when you're dealing with some very dark and or strange subjects. I'm thinking of the last book that I recorded here. I think it was the last one I did, which is Annie Dunn, the Sebastian Barry, which has this sort of, and it's from my home place, Wicklow, so it resonated with me a great deal. And there's some unspoken darkness throughout that book. And yet the warmth between the characters is extraordinary, incredibly moving, though almost nothing is ever said overtly. Nothing is said overtly. But underneath it all, there's something going on. Oh, Kelsha is a distant place, over the mountains from everywhere. You go over the mountains to get there, and eventually, through dreams, I can picture the two children in their coats arriving. It is the start of the summer, and all the customs of winter and spring are behind us. Not that those customs are tended to now much. My grand-nephew and grand-niece, titles that sound like the children of a Russian czar. My crab-apple tree seems to watch over their coming, like a poor man forever waiting for alms with cap in hand.
Annie Dunn by Sebastian Barry, narrated by my guest today, Caroline Lennon. We're talking about Irish stories, and there's a lot of Irish literature deals with the Irish diaspora around the world and homecomings and fractured families. Do you think that's something that's particular to Irish literature? The far-flung brothers, sisters, cousins all coming back to the homestead?
Yeah, well, it's certainly very specific to the Irish experience. I mean, all of my family have lived abroad for long periods. I mean, I've lived in England, and as has my sister, for a long time. My brother, I also lived in Japan. My brother lived in Japan. He's now living back home. So that experience of travel is the norm for Irish people. Most people will have a good number of their family who have gone abroad to live and sometimes never return. So it is a huge part of the Irish experience from, you know, about the 1840s, 50s, when the first great waves of emigration happened. It is part and parcel of our whole experience. So it would be odd not to cover it. It's that much of an extreme. We are wanderers. I think it's similar to the Jewish experience. You know that they. So it is a very it's very touchy, of course, because it's associated with a lot of loss. On the upside, of course, it means it's great to be outward looking and being fortunate enough to be allowed to go to other countries and make your living. So it contains everything within it, the best aspects of experience and some of the darker aspects, for sure.
Yes, and actually in books like Anne Enright's The Green Road, you have the tragedy and the laugh-out-loud humour.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I was lucky enough to record that. And I recognised so many of those characters. I just, you know, my own mother was marvellous. But the difficult mother in that is not a stage show. It's a real person. I mean, I guarantee you we've all met one of her. And I was barking out loud. And she's particularly good. I have to say openly that I knew Anne Enright at Trinity. So I might be slightly more on her side anyway. But she's wonderful at evoking the landscape too, which is another very important feature in Irish writing. Most of us came from a rural background, even if we weren't working on the farms ourselves. So the land is still incredibly important to us. And I think so, a writer who can describe it as vividly as she can, as in Sebastian Barry too, it's incredibly moving to us. And I think it conveys to people around the world. There's something eternal about that.
And you're not just limited to reading books by Irish authors. There's some great chick lit and young adult fiction in there as well, I've noticed.
Yes, I was very, very lucky. I mean, I started off by doing a lot of chick lit, which is very entertaining and on the lighter side. And then suddenly, somehow, possibly by mistake, I think I got offered a detective fiction to do. And I thought, oh, yes, I'll have a go at it, because I'm an inveterate television watcher, as my friends will attest. And so I thought, oh, fantastic. And so I started doing a lot of that. And that's been very challenging because, of course, there's endless different types of scenes that you have to learn to do and keep up the energy. And then somebody said to me, oh, do you fancy doing this? Some young adult. I thought, oh, I'll give that a go. And of course, that's another thing entirely, because the energy, of course, for young adult fiction is so exhausting. So you leave a day and you think, oh, well, I need to lie down now. But it's lovely. And I love the thought that, you know, some young people are getting to hear a book maybe that they wouldn't otherwise. And, you know, it's great. It's all gravy, as they say. The variety is great, actually, because I think if you were only doing one type of fiction, I think that would be not very motivating, I think, because you'd sort of feel, oh, I know what's about to happen now. You'd always feel that. But I'm lucky.
You mentioned how important it is for books to be made accessible to those who might not be able physically to read them. Do you have any connection to sight loss yourself?
No, fortunately I don't, but my grandmother was a great reader, and as people age, you could see her no longer being able to read became a loss to her. And I have another friend of mine, John Cormack, I think, has recorded for RNIB indeed. His mother went blind, and we've talked about this a lot, that it's a fantastic feeling ever to be able to just lighten the burden, I think. And because if you are a lover of books, you know what that means to people. And I think that, you know, what little bit you can do, why not do it? I think it's fantastic.
I certainly, as a lover of books who's lost my sight, it was one of the cruelest things to lose. You lose the ability to step outside your physical situation if you can't read. And having somebody reading those stories to you is a huge comfort.
I think why it moves people so much is it sort of harks back to how we used to hear stories. You know, I think that in Ireland we call it the Shanachí, which is the old person who'd go around, and older person who used to go around the different houses and tell the stories. And, you know, you have it with Homer, so the travelling storyteller. So that telling of stories from one human being to another answers a very fundamental need, and it sort of predates the printed book, and so here I think you're getting the best of both worlds. You're getting the modern book, but you're getting that ancient human connection between, you know, human being to human being, the human voice sharing a story. And I like you, I feel very much the same way, that even if I'm reading a book that the story is not mine. It's quite different. I mightn't even like the themes. But that opportunity to step outside of your own experience is something that's incredibly valuable to you, and I think a very necessary part of the human experience.
Well, Caroline Lennon, thank you so much for being our Shanahi, and I look forward to hearing your voice in my headphones for many years to come.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks to Caroline Lennon. Her reading of Annie Dunn by Sebastian Barry is TB21111. And you can find a full list of the books that she's narrated by searching the library website, rniblibrary.com, or calling the helpline on 0303 123 9999. This is Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to T.C. Boyle for the books of his life, here's Robert Kirkwood with news of an essential handbook for young listeners.
The world is full of monsters. Ogres, hobgoblins, trolls, crusted hairy snot nibblers. They're all out there, causing trouble or trying to eat your aunt. And we need your help to stop them. Are you ready to be a monster hunter? Well, the debut children's novel from author Ian Mark could help. Monster Hunting for Beginners is narrated by Nigel Pilkington.
I'd never encountered a real-life monster in the flesh before, unless you include Aunt Prudence, and I can't think of a good reason why you wouldn't. So, when I tell you that he was the biggest and scariest brute I'd ever seen in my life, that probably isn't saying much. But he was.
Ian Mark joins me now. Now, Ian, big dumb question to start with. Tell us about the book.
I like dumb questions, to be honest. They're my favourite kind of questions. So, Monster Hunter for Beginners is about a boy called Jack who has spent his whole life believing in monsters and being told that they don't exist, and then wakes up one morning to find an ogre sitting in his garden. And soon after that, he's apprenticed to a 200-year-old grumpy monster hunter called Stoop, and given a magical book, also called Monster Hunter for Beginners, which contains details and lists of all the monsters in the world. And together they set off for the town of King's Mews in Cornwall to deal with an ogre, which has also taken up residence on the hill above the town. And that's how it begins.
As you say, the book's set in Cornwall. Is that a particularly monstrous region?
It actually is, yes. It's really... it's stuffed full of giants and ogres. You can't, you know, walk a mile in Cornwall without coming across an ogre. So it was the perfect place to set this particular book because it is, obviously, it's about giants and ogres. So it never even occurred to me to set it anywhere else but Cornwall. And also because Jack finds out in the course of the story that he's descended from Jack the Giant Killer, who himself was originally from Cornwall. And obviously... he was supposed to have killed all the giants in Cornwall at one stage, but clearly didn't do a very good job of it because there were still so many of them knocking about.
Now, isn't that the message in Monster Hunting for Beginners? You can hunt them, but you can't kill them.
That's true, yes. Jack the Giant Killer, the original one, he went around slaughtering giants left, right and centre to the point where you actually feel sorry for the giants whenever they have to come across them. Nowadays... Jack finds out that there are more rules around monster hunting and monsters have to be captured and rehabilitated. You can't kill them because monsters have rights too.
Now, one monster I love, tell us about the crusty, hairy snot nibbler.
Yeah, that's one of my favourites too. And funnily enough, the book is illustrated by an animator and illustrator called Louis Gibault, and his picture of the crusted, hairy snot nibbler is actually one of my favourites. Pictures in the book. It explains in the book that the crusted hairy snot nibbler is neither crusted or even that hairy and doesn't nibble snot. And the only reason he got that name is because he was named by someone who didn't know what the words crusted hairy snot or nibble meant. But he's a warthog with one eye, nine stumpy legs, and tusks so long that they can pick up radio stations on three continents. And it's most commonly found in wooded areas of Papua New Guinea, and it's best approached with caution, not to mention a peg on the end of your nose. And as I say, he was you know, brilliantly illustrated by Louis Gibault.
Well, you mentioned the illustrations. That's an unfortunate reality of being on RNIB Connect Radio. When we download the audiobook, we don't get the illustrations. Can you give us a flavour of the cover?
The cover is, it shows, there are lots of tentacles, which are mentioned very prominently in chapter one. And it features the three main characters, Jack, who I mentioned, Stoop, the 200-year-old grumpy monster hunter who takes Jack on as an apprentice, and also Nancy, who's a girl that Jack meets when he first arrives in Cornwall. And together they all team up to deal with the ogres. It's a really, it's a wonderful, colourful cover with a huge shadow of an ogre, and also the supposed villain of the book, Aunt Prudence, who's also featured there. It's a really richly illustrated cover. It's really very lovely. I'm delighted when I saw it.
His skin was green and lumpy like nine-day-old mould. He had disgusting yellow tusks that looked as if they'd never heard of toothpaste, let alone touched it, in the last 100 years. And he was wearing what had to be one of the world's top five most torn and dirty pairs of trousers. Aunt Prudence was getting an even closer look at the ogre than I was, because he'd picked her up tightly in his fist like a chocolate bar and was opening his mouth as if to bite off her head as she struggled to get free, kicking her legs in midair and crying, "Let me go!"
Now, the audiobook's narrated by Nigel Pilkington. Did you have any choice in the narrator?
I was sent a variety of clips of, you know, potential voices for the audiobook. And I also then went to the different performers and actors' websites to, you know, hear more samples of their work. And they were all great, and they're all, you know, very different styles. But Nigel Pilkington, he was so funny, and he really found the humour in every word, in every sort of joke, in every page. And yeah, it's funny listening to it, because even though I wrote those words, when you hear him reading them, it's like I'm hearing them for the first time, and I'm laughing at things that I didn't even know were funny that he's found in it. So it's a great audiobook.
Yeah, a lot of people say that it changes the reading experience.
It really does, yeah. Yeah, and it's funny because so much time passes from when you write a book to when it's published to when, you know, an audiobook is made. And you forget an awful lot of the things that you, you know, that you wrote. To go back to the illustrations, there's a picture in the book of an ogre on a pogo stick. And I saw that picture, and it's a very funny picture. And I thought, I don't remember writing about an ogre on a pogo stick. And so I went back to look at it, and, you know, sure enough, I had done that. I just completely forgotten. And the illustrator had obviously found this detail within the book and, you know, drawn a picture and found the humour in it. And it's the same with someone reading an audiobook. They find things that you forgot were there or you didn't know were there.
Did you not fancy doing it yourself?
No, I don't. I'd be terrible. I can't do voices, for one thing. And I know, like, when you have such a large cast of characters, different accents and so on, when I used to read picture books to my children when they were young, I used to try to do accents, and they would just laugh at me. So I don't think I'd be very good. I'm in awe of actors and in general and what they're able to do with a text, you know, but it's not something I could ever do.
Now, you say some of the monsters are based on real-life myths. What's your favourite one?
Yeah, well, I love lots of, like, mine goblins. I particularly like sort of monsters who live underground inside mines and in caves and so on. And I think that probably goes back to when I was young and reading, you know, books like The Hobbit and so on, where, you know, Bilbo would go underground and meet all these strange creatures. And also, another one of my favourite books when I was young, Alan Garner's Wisdom of the Zingerman, where again they go underground. So I'm very fond of, you know, cave-dwelling monsters and trolls and things that live in the dark.
Wasn't there a myth about miners, that they would hear tapping noises as to where the best
In Cornwall, yeah, they're known as knockers, or spriggans is another name. But they were known as knockers because they used to knock when they found a particularly rich seam of tin. And then the miners would follow the knocks and then, you know, be able to mine the tin. But like all of those creatures, they hated swearing, apparently. So if the miners swore, then the knockers wouldn't help them. So it helped moderate their language too.
Now, this is the first book in a series, so we'll hear more from Jack.
Yes, definitely. I've finished the second book in the series, and there's another one planned beyond that, and hopefully many more if children like them.
Don't just stand there. Do something, she shouted when she saw me. If I'm honest, and I usually am, I couldn't help thinking that getting eaten would serve her right for being so mean. In fact, I felt a bit sorry for the ogre, because someone as sour and nasty as Aunt Prudence was bound to give him a worse case of indigestion than a whole vinegar and raw onion pie right before bedtime. Luckily for her, I'm not the sort of boy who stands idly by while monsters eat people, not even foul-tempered ants.
Final clip from Monster Hunting for Beginners by Ian Mark. The audio version is read by Nigel Pilkington. It's available in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books. And as it's published by Farshore Books, a division of HarperCollins, we hope it's on its way to the RNIB Talking Books Library soon. And Ian, thanks so much.
Thank you. Great interview. Thank you.
Thanks, Robert. Now it's back to T.C. Boyle for the books of his life.
So, was there a book as a child or youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, we've talked about animals in my new book, which deals with animal consciousness. As a child, I read animal books, and I'm not talking about Winnie the Pooh necessarily, although, of course, I love that. But books in which we are realistic, books in which we are the consciousness of an animal. I remember one about the dwarf deer in the Key Islands off of Florida and how exciting that was for me. But really, I didn't come into the idea of being a writer until I was a teenager and discovered Franz Kafka, particularly his stories like The Burrow or Metamorphosis or A Hunger Artist. He lit me up in the way that I could see the absurdity of the world and how to approach it in a non-linear, more imaginative sort of way. So I think that was probably the biggest spur for me to become a writer. And of course, because it was, for us as teenagers, it threw all the rules out. It was completely outrageous. It was something we'd never seen before. And there's whimsy. There's a whimsy that you don't get in The Trial, for instance.
When Gregor Samsa awoke one morning from troubled dreams, he found himself changed into a monstrous cockroach in his bed. He lay on his tough, armoured back and, raising his head a little, managed to see, sectioned off by little crescent-shaped ridges into segments, the expanse of his arched brown belly, atop which the coverlet perched, forever on the point of slipping off entirely. His numerous legs, pathetically frail by contrast to the rest of him, waved feebly before his eyes. "What's the matter with me?" he thought. It was no dream. There, quietly between the four familiar walls, was his room. A normal human room, if always a little on the small side.
The Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka is narrated by Damien Lynch, Thomas Eyre and Steve Hodson, and it's available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Is there a book that you'd like to curl up with on a rainy day and reread?
Well, I've been doing a lot of that during the pandemic lockdown. And by the way, sadly, we are back to wearing masks again. Even we who got vaccinated the minute it was available. Earlier this year, the BBC did, again, a dramatization of All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot. That prompted me to reread the book. And that is the one I would curl up with because it is so charming, delightful, and also it deals with being of service to humanity and, of course, by extension, to the animals. He was a veterinarian. I am forever charmed by these stories, and it was a wonderful reread this winter. The Harriet stories completely delight me.
Jim, come over here and look at these little beggars. Tristan laughed excitedly as he leaned over the door of the pigsty. I walked across the yard. What is it? Well, I've just given them their swill, and it's a bit hot. Just look at them. The little pigs were seizing the food, dropping it, and walking suspiciously around it. Then they would creep up, touch the hot potatoes with their muzzles, and leap back in alarm. There was none of the usual mealtime slobbering, just a puzzled grunting. Right from the start, Tristan had found the pigs more interesting than the hens, which was a good thing, because he had to retrieve himself after the poultry disaster. He spent a lot of time in the yard, sometimes feeding or mucking out, but more often resting his elbows on the door, watching his charges. As with the hens, he was more interested in their characters than their ability to produce pork or bacon. After he poured the swill into the long trough, he always watched, entranced, while the pigs made their first rush.
Arthur Blake narrating All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And lastly, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend to the Read On listeners?
Yes, because we are talking about animals today. Here is one of the two books that totally inspired me to write Talk to Me. Nim Chimpsky by Elizabeth Hess. So Nim is, along with Washo, the most famous of the chimps. And again, as in my book, raised as a human being, but with tragic consequences. It is a biography, not a biography of a human being, but a biography of an animal. And it's very powerful and fascinating.
Unfortunately, Nim Chimpsky, The Chimp That Would Be Human, by Elizabeth Hess, isn't available in audio, but you can find it in print commercially.
Well, T.C. Boyle, thank you so much for joining us on Read On. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and we hope to talk to you again very soon.
Likewise, Hannah.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsail, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.